Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mike Pesca sitting in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And tell me if you've seen this analysis, this very analysis of President Obama's upcoming address on the end of combat operations in Iraq, because I heard it on CNN. I read it in a number of AP headlines, and I saw it on the elevator ride up here. You know, those little vertical blurbs that kind of get lodged in your head more than anything else in the news. And the analysis is reduced to the following thoughtlet. He's not going to say mission accomplished. That seems to be the most important thing that the analysts are talking about. Obama will not say mission accomplished. And I guess that's a version of learning from history. But according to our next guest, Andrew Bacevich, it is far from the most important thing to learn. Bacevich is the author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He's also a professor of international relations and history at Boston University, West Point graduate, Vietnam veteran, his former colonel in the Army, which I find impressive, but he describes in his book as nothing more than a spear carrier. Hello, welcome, Professor Bacevich. How are you?
I'm very fine.
So the end of combat operations, we know it doesn't mean mission accomplished. What does it mean?
Well, it doesn't mean mission accomplished. It also doesn't mean that the Iraq War is ended. I mean, it occurs to me that we might liken the invasion of Iraq to lighting a house on fire and creating a great conflagration. We've stayed long enough to put some of the fire out, and now we're sort of saying, well, that's all we can do, and we're moving on. It is ending, not in defeat, but it's absurd to claim that we've achieved a victory. I think it really ought to be a moment of a deep reflection in which we should be careful not to move on from Iraq too quickly and ask ourselves what ought to be learned from this horrific 7-year experience.
For a military man, does the president saying our combat operations are over, does that have real meaning? Will a colonel in Iraq's day-to-day duties be much different next month than it was last month because of the announcement or because of the circumstances that led to the announcement?
Oh, I think it's not going to be a dramatic change. I think that the change has been, the on-the-ground change has been in process for some time, with the U.S. attempting to have a lower profile in terms of the actual conduct of day-to-day operations and passing off the responsibility for day-to-day operations to Iraqis. But there is so much uncertainty. The insurgency has not been eliminated, not by a long shot. The institutions of government in Baghdad are clearly fragile. Their legitimacy is really questionable. I'm in the camp that says that the history of Iraq or of the Iraq War is a long way from being fully written. The president apparently is going to say that from now on that writing is going to be done by Iraqis.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably true.
Now, I could glean from just the subtitles of your four books, maybe there are more, but subtitles in 2005 you wrote The New American Militarism. So the subtitle there was How Americans Are Seduced by War. And in 2008, the Limits of Power subtitle was The End of American Exceptionalism. In this book, Washington Rules, the subtitle is America's Path to Permanent War. These are of a piece, and you haven't been contradicting yourself, at least. So you spoke before about what the lesson is and what does it mean. In a nutshell, what does it mean?
Well, I think there's many things that we should learn from this. And the least important thing we should learn from this is, to take a certain number of tactical lessons from Iraq and to try to apply them to Afghanistan, even though I suspect that's about all that we are going to learn. I think the most important thing to learn is that the world really is not malleable, that our capacity to understand what people on the other side of the world want and need is really quite limited. And the notion that even though we are the most powerful nation in the world, that we can direct the destiny of peoples on the other side of the world is something that gets us into trouble. It costs us enormous quantities of blood and of money, and creates it embeds us in moral complications that we're really not prepared to deal with. What we should come away from Iraq deeply humbled.
And President George W. Bush talked about a humble foreign policy and having humility, but you think those were just words?
Well, gracious sakes, he talked about that when he was campaigning for the presidency as Governor Bush back in the year 2000. After 9/11, George W. Bush utterly abandoned the notion of taking a humble approach to the world. And he, more than any recent statesman, I think, embraced this notion of American power being sufficient to remake the world. That's what he set out to do in the Islamic world in his global war on terror. It hasn't worked. It won't work. And I think that the so-called end of combat operations in Iraq really is a moment when we ought to reflect on, yes, what we have accomplished, but also on how much it's cost and how limited our achievements have been.
Talking with Andrew Bacevich, a former Army colonel, current professor, author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, and as scathing as you are in your criticism of George W. Bush, you wrote this in The New Republic: who is more deserving of contempt, the commander-in-chief who sends young Americans to die for a cause, however misguided, in which he sincerely believes, and I assume you're talking about George W. Bush in that case, or the commander-in-chief who sends young Americans to die for a cause in which he manifestly does not believe and yet refuses to forsake? And you put President Obama in that category. Elsewhere in that piece, you just say that Obama has a lack of guts to get out of Afghanistan and Iraq. It's no more complicated than that?
No, I don't. I think it's much more complicated than that. But the argument to the piece is that President Obama, as the anti-Iraq war candidate, ran for the presidency vowing to change the way Washington works. I had hoped, perhaps naively, that one of the changes he would be willing to undertake would be a thoroughgoing reassessment of the basic approach we have to national security policy. That's the approach I try to describe in my new book.
And here is, go ahead,
sure.
Please, finish.
Well, it just struck me that the Afghanistan decision that he made in December of 2009 really was his opportunity to declare that he intended to change course in national security. And the decision he rendered to prolong and to escalate the Afghanistan war really was the same decision that John McCain would have made had we elected John McCain. And I think implicitly was a decision that indicated he had no intention of changing the way Washington works when it comes to basic national security policy.
And how Washington works in your book, you lay out, you say, since Truman, all our leaders have bought into four assumptions. I'll summarize them if I can. The assumptions are the world must be shaped, only the U.S. can shape it, we'll define how the shaping goes, and except for some rogues and recalcitrants, your phrase, everyone basically agrees with us on this point. And so my question is, if you disagree with these assertions, what's the implication? Does that mean chaos is okay, or do you say that there won't be chaos? Are you pro-isolationists? What does contradicting those assertions mean for the U.S. in reality, if we were to contradict those assertions, not live by them?
Well, let me say first off, and it's important that you introduce the word isolationism into the conversation. What I'm about to say, I don't mean to be antagonistic, but so much one of the chief reasons I think that our discussion and debate about national security is so thin is that there seems to be this assumption that the only alternative to doing what we do today is isolationism. You know, that either we are going to have to be engaged in wars in the Persian Gulf and in Central Asia until the cows come home, on the one hand, or it's kind of pull up the drawbridges and stick our head in the sand. And I would argue strongly that there are more than two choices, that there are choices that are between these two extremes that ought to be explored. But let's go back to the whole question that, you know, we're called upon to organize and transform the world. I think, again, that that assertion, and it's something that's deeply embedded in our sense of what America is all about, is based on a faulty understanding of history and of the way the world works. The understanding of history I'm referring to here is the assumption that somehow or other, if humankind can simply exert itself strongly enough, that peace will reign and all will be well. I think it's time for us to grow up and to recognize that the story of history really is a tragic one, that there is no utopia at the end of the road, that the best we can do is to cope with the conditions that we confront. And coping doesn't mean putting your head in the sand, but it means to have fairly limited expectations about what your power can do, and indeed especially limited expectations about what military power can do. I mean, let's go back to President Obama in Afghanistan. I mean, this is now the longest war in American history, and the assumption continues to be that the United States has the capacity to pacify this country, to build effective and legitimate institutions. This president, who promised to change everything, is committed to that proposition. And it seems to me to be not only patently absurd, but also deeply inconsistent with our own interests. You know, the other day, Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that the biggest threat to American security is the size of the national debt. Maybe a little hyperbole there, but I think basically he's probably right. We are spending ourselves into bankruptcy. We are imposing on future generations a burden of debt that will cause them to curse us because of what their inheritance will be. Limiting the size of our defense budget in and of itself is not going to solve that problem. But if we persist in thinking that these open-ended wars have to be pursued, that we are simply making that problem all the worse.
If the United States, if Obama were to have taken your advice, say, and drawn troops down in Afghanistan, if there weren't 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, forecast what you think things would look like for Afghanistan and for the world in a couple of years. Would it be like the war you fought in, where the United States withdrew from Vietnam and it toppled in 2 years, and everything's basically okay afterwards?
Well, I think that's an interesting analogy to make. I mean, first of all, I'll give you a forecast, but, you know, my forecast and $1.85 will get you a tall coffee, right? but seriously, no, the notion that people in Washington or people in academia are so smart that they can predict the future is itself one of the absurdities that we find ourselves burdened with. But the reference to Vietnam is, I think, a very useful one here, because the argument for staying the course in Vietnam, of course, was based on a false perception of reality, a perception that this thing called monolithic communism posed a threat to the United States of America, a looming threat, when in fact monolithic communism had ceased to exist by the 1960s. When we finally withdrew from Vietnam, there was a mess in the wake of our departure. There were people who were killed, who were prosecuted. I wouldn't want to minimize that for a second. And yet today, Vietnam United is on the road to development. It is not a perfect country. And yet, by allowing the Vietnamese people to exercise their right to self-determination, they've actually done a lot better for themselves than anything we were presuming to do for them during the Vietnam War. I'm not saying that that would necessarily be the case in Afghanistan. I am saying that we need to be, I think, acutely sensitive to to the historical evidence that suggests that when we presume to know what's good for other people, we may well do more mischief than we do good.
Mike Pesca, I just wanted to tell everyone what we're listening to. I'm Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer, and we're speaking with Andrew Bacevich, who's written The Washington Rules, America's Path to a Permanent War. And I did want to get a caller in because you referenced General Mullen. I think Dan from Bridgewater, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I'm a survivor of 9/11, and I was very surprised to see that how when George Bush said in less than 1 year after 9/11, he didn't give a damn whether bin Laden is dead or alive. And then Mullen, in 2008, the last year of the Bush administration, told Congress, in Iraq we do what we must, in Afghanistan we do what we can. And now it turns out that what we can becomes what we must again. So is this just perpetual warfare to keep a bunch of Star Horde generals employed?
Thanks for your call, Dan. And how much do you blame the generals themselves? Are they just a symptom of the problem?
I think the generals, the politicians, many members of the mainstream media have completely bought into the national security consensus that I describe in the book, and they are unable to ask first order questions about the policies we pursue. They are unable to conceive of any alternatives, and so they perpetuate errors. I mean, the caller is exactly right. What a remarkable fact that when the so-called global war on terror begins, it begins in Afghanistan, it then moves on to Iraq, and now it moves back to Afghanistan again. This is progress? I don't think so. And indeed, we're in Afghanistan, even though people like Mullen and others would acknowledge that there probably aren't more than 100 or 200 al-Qaeda operatives present in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda does pose a threat to the United States, and yet al-Qaeda is not headquartered or centered or concentrated in Afghanistan. The problem is a transnational one. So how can fighting a decade-long war in one underdeveloped country possibly provide a rational response to this transnational threat that is not in particular located in Afghanistan? It really makes no sense. Strategically, the Afghanistan war makes no more sense than the Iraq war did.
I wanted to ask you a question about you personally. In 2007, your son was serving in Iraq, and he was killed on Mother's Day, I believe, in 2007. I don't know if you were writing a book at the time. Did it change what you wanted to say? Did it ratchet up how vehemently you wanted to say it? How did that change your message?
Well, who knows? I mean, I think most of us, our lives are touched by tragedy of one kind or another. And how can we say the way personal loss affects our perspective on things? I don't think it's possible for me to disentangle all that.
Right.
What I would say is that I try very hard to keep personal things personal and to do the best I can to approach problems from an analytical, detached point of view, to call them the way I see them, to not have my writing somehow stem from some sort of personal grudge or personal feelings one way or the other. And I would hope that if people find occasion to read my book, they would take the book at face value. They may agree with it, they may disagree with it, but I've simply tried to do my best as a citizen to explain why I think that the national security path we've been going down for decades now no longer serves the nation's interests and really needs to be rethought.
And I've been reading your work ever since 2002 and American Empire, which predated your son's death. I think, if I'm getting the timeline right, did it predate his joining the military?
That's correct.
Yes. Yeah, so you've been remarkably consistent. I remember hearing after, and I knew who you were, I heard on NPR they did a story about you and your son, and you said you never talked to him or kind of burdened him with your political philosophy of the war. But what kind of conversations did you have, just because you were, the father and son were doing such similar things and, you know, you thought with such similar conflicts. So what kind of conversations did you have?
You know, I really am not comfortable talking about personal things like that. And I wonder if we could just sort of go back into policy issues.
Yes, of course. Sure. So, I mean, the only reason I was interested was because I'm interested how the biography shapes the person.
Let me
I know that in your book you talk about how when you were a young man, you were a young man in a hurry. You not only talk about yourself that way, but other famous military people who didn't have a chance to analyze. So not talking about your son, but just about you and being a soldier. You never had a chance to analyze until you got some – you were removed from the fighting to some extent.
Yeah, I think, I mean, and here I'll make a broader comment that maybe it gets to where you want to go, and that is that, you know, the soldiering is a demanding profession. It is a consuming profession. It consumes your energy. It's difficult. And I think that it asks too much of our young soldiers to expect them to walk around critically assessing the policies that they are charged with implementing. We want to have a military that is disciplined and effective, and that means that the sergeants and the lieutenants and the captains receive their orders, are given their missions, and they go out and implement them with energy as best they can. That's what makes a good soldier. Now, I think that the downside of being involved in or being embedded in that kind of a professional framework is that it does become difficult over time. I think your critical, whatever critical capacities you have, become dulled over time.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking for me personally, it was only when I left the military profession and began a journey to a new profession that I was able to see things, I think, with a certain amount of critical distance. And in that sense, that was when, speaking for me personally, learning really began to be possible.
Andrew Bacevich, author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
And up in a minute, we'll be discussing flooding in Pakistan. Of course, big geopolitical consequences to that, as well as humanitarian ones. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC.